Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and we've created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. And we hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. Thank you for listening. So my guest today spent 18 years at the Financial Times, where she ran the paper's corporate coverage during the financial crisis and rose to become the FT's business editor. Before joining the FT, she worked in emerging market fund management, Citigroup and Foreign and Colonial, and started her career working for the UN Trade and Development Debt Management Program in Geneva. She has a BA Honours in English Literature from Cambridge and a Master's degree in Latin American Politics and Economics from Oxford. She was a panel member of the recent inquiry into the future of civil society and is a trustee of one of the UK's largest volunteering charities, as well as a visiting professor at King's College London. She's recently become the Chief Executive Officer of the Impact Investing Institute. Sarah Gordon, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Thank you very much.
Sarah, let's jump straight in. Tell me, what makes a successful journalist in the world of finance?
I think interest in the story is absolutely fundamental. I mean, some of the things that happened when I was running the company's desk, or indeed writing at the FT, we had obviously the financial crisis, which was, I mean, it was awful. The impact on people was absolutely terrible. But I have to be honest and tell you that as a story, it was the best story ever. And I've never felt, the FT felt absolutely central. Its role was so important to that story because we were trying really carefully and really in a really committed way to explain a very complicated and quite difficult to understand situation for many people. And we worked incredibly hard. I mean, when I was running the company's desk, I don't know if you remember, but most of the banks would tend to go down. The news would be rumoured on a Sunday because that was when all the discussions would take place. And then the news would come out first thing on a Monday. So we had these incredibly busy weekends. It was a demanding time, but we felt very central. So I think, to answer your question, I think real enthusiasm for the story and interest in the story. And the best editors, I think, are the ones who really are just that fundamental love of a good story is the basis for everything. And then I think knowledge is important, understanding the concepts that you're talking about. And it's not always the case in journalism, to put it mildly. And then I think responsible journalism, we have had a rule at the FT that everything must be double-sourced. And that meant that sometimes we didn't get the story because we only had one source and other newspapers or other media outlets would break the story. But we felt passionately that getting it right was more important than being first. So that rigour and that remains at the heart of the ST's journalism. And I think it's a very important reason why it remains such a trusted and I hope, readable outlet.
And on that particular part of your journey, were there any overt or covert glass ceilings or barriers that made life more difficult?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting as a woman, I interviewed Gloria Steinem, who's the great US feminist, as you undoubtedly know. And she said women are the only group of people who get more radical with age. And I think that certainly in my case, that was true. And in a lot of other women, and indeed men that I know, I think, as I said, I had a very privileged upbringing. I went to some very good universities. I worked in many, when I was in fund management, I was often the only woman in the room and often the only woman in the team. But I was often also the youngest person in the team. And frankly, I didn't feel disadvantaged in any way. And of course, I wasn't. I was hugely advantaged in many ways, not particularly by my gender, but by my background. But as you get older and you start to deal with the realities of children and family life and aging parents and the demands of a busy job, I think a lot of women come up against not so much a glass ceiling, but the real practical challenges of managing a job at the same time as the rest of life. There was that. I think I was very lucky at the FT. The FT was an extremely humane and constructive employer, in the sense that, I mean, I had a number of health problems when I was in my late 20s and 30s, and the FT was extremely understanding about it. I worked part-time from when I became pregnant with my daughter, and I never worked full-time again until, in fact, I left the FT, and I'm now working very full-time.
And is there any particular advice you might impart to people earlier on their journey running into some of those issues that you learned from?
I think increasingly, I mean, there are issues around gender in most workplaces. There are things that leaders need to do about making sure that women's voices are heard, and not just women, but certainly at the FT, you know, it was a very sort of Oxbridge-y environment, in which if you were confident and able to put your point of view forward confidently, you tended to dominate, and men tended to dominate more than women. But I think that leaders in any size team, and I'm now running a very small team, but I try to do this, you can bring out people's views in many different ways. You need to invite views, and you need to create environments where people of all sorts of diverse views can be heard, because that's how you reach the best conclusions, not because you argue the best, but because you've reached genuinely a thought through and thoughtful conclusion. I mean, increasingly, I do think that a lot of issues are around how we bring up boys and how we divide the sort of domestic and emotional labour of the home as much as what goes on in the workplace. And I think that we're clearly not doing right by our boys. Too many young men suffering from such serious mental health challenges. And too many couples, and not just heterosexual couples of all types, but really still there are too many occasions when women do a completely unfair share both of the domestic labour and what Hillary Clinton calls the emotional labour. The remembering the birthdays, the planning parents' evenings. And I think people really, I would advise young people to have really honest discussions with their partners about how they're going to address that. And it's not just about goodwill, sadly, it's about changing processes.
That's very, very helpful. Was there a light bulb moment where after 18 years at the FT and this very successful career, you suddenly say, okay, this is for me, the chief executive of the Impact Investing Institute?
I think a number of things happened at the same time. I mean, in the external world, what happened was that my job as business editor was designed to be really thinking thematically about the big issues across Europe, and that was Europe, including the UK. And of course, it became, from early 2016 onwards, very much dominated by Brexit. I think we all need to move forward from where we are now, but certainly in terms of what my journalism was being asked to focus on was increasingly very domestic. I think also I'd been trying for many years, I'd been making contacts in a number of the areas in which I'm now working, and really increasingly interested in the role of sort of purpose in the business world and around positive impact and how some of these issues, and it meshed very much with my interests in workplace diversity, that I'd been talking to some incredibly interesting people, of whom Elizabeth Corley, who's now the chair of the Impact Investing Institute. We are here to get more money into positive social and environmental investment. And that's investment that delivers a positive social environmental benefit alongside a financial return. So our mission is to make the market work better, help people engage with impact investment, try to create an enabling and supportive policy and regulatory environment for impact investment, and in general, just move impact investment much higher up everybody's agenda, the public, institutional investors and policymakers.
I think you've written millennials are set to inherit $30 trillion in the largest wealth transfer ever, and 85% of millennials want investment directed towards sustainable and responsible investing. How are you being received?
It feels an amazing moment to be involved in launching. I mean, we launched officially only last November. It feels an amazing moment both for the Institute to be starting and for me personally to be involved in this, because there is massive, massive momentum behind this. I mean, from all different areas. I mean, as you just mentioned, there's increasing evidence, and you can see with Extinction Rebellion that there is a enormous amount of sort of anger and activism around particularly the environmental agenda. but not just young people. I mean, you mentioned millennials, but I think you and I would agree. I mean, I've minded about the impact of my behavior and my investments all my life. I just haven't been very good or felt I had very good guidance about how to have that impact. And this is precisely what we're trying to address. So it's not just the public, it's also that institutional investors, whether asset managers or pension scheme trustees, are much more aware of the need not just to consider sort of ESG risks, but also to think much more proactively about the impact of their investments and of their investment strategies. And then I think policymakers are, I mean, they're not as aware as we would like them to be, but that's a very important part of our work. Policymakers are increasingly aware of the role of mobilising private sector capital towards some of these social and environmental goals. So I think it's really a really hope that it's a very important sort of sweet spot in terms of those different impulses and a moment of real opportunity.
And how should the investment industry think about benchmarks in this world?
I mean, that's a very important question. And of course, there are a number of already sort of indices that have been constructed more around ESG than around impact. So more around the avoiding harm end of the spectrum of capital, rather than what we talk about is we talk about that spectrum moving from avoiding harm to benefiting stakeholders to contributing to solutions. So as you move along that spectrum, you move more and more towards real measurable positive impact. However, so many of the indices now are constructed around more the avoid harm end of that spectrum. So what we call the sort of ESG end of things. I think those indices perform a useful function. I think at the moment, it's incredibly difficult to benchmark. What we do know is that some of the fund managers like who are very focused on this space, like Bridges, like Generation Investment Management, have significantly outperformed traditional benchmarks over the last 10 to 20 years. So there appears to be, and I mean, there needs to be more research on this, and there is some specific research which we can talk about, but there appears to be a significant benefit, not just in your appeal to clients, but also in your performance from really engaging with this space.
So I suppose I'm intrigued. On the one hand, you've got Larry Fink writing his letter and encouraging that debate. On the other hand, I think attributed to Warren Buffett, the dangers of investing based on labels. And I guess I'm intrigued as to how you think this plays out, because we have underneath it companies that are, BP might be one, but in transition. How do you think about that?
Yes, I mean, that's an incredibly important point and one that we really want policymakers, particularly in the UK, actually to engage with in the run-up to COP26, you know, the big environmental conference this autumn, which is being held in Glasgow. There are sort of two different elements to the answer. One is that we need to encourage companies, we need to encourage them to engage with the idea of a transition to a net zero economy, a carbon net zero economy. We need to think about incentives and encouragement for that transition. But then I also think, which goes far beyond the environmental impact of companies' behaviour and investors' concerns, is around the area of what kind of companies are going to be genuinely profitable in the future, what kind of companies are going to have genuinely sustainable profit streams. And we believe very strongly that it is those companies that engage in genuinely sustainable behaviour that are making their future profit streams far more resilient. Now, what does that mean? That means that if you're a mining company and you're not thinking about your water use or the degradation of the environment in which you work, you are going to be punished by regulation, you're going to be punished by policy, you're going to be punished by investors, as well as, of course, let us not forget the people living in those areas who will be suffering from those negative impacts. So I think it's about good business sense. And those companies which are on the front foot now and which are thinking really constructively and proactively about both their positive and their negative impacts, and crucially reporting on them and holding themselves accountable for that impact, those are the ones who are going to be on the front foot in terms of what kind of behaviour that future investors will reward.
That should include companies like Amazon with their water use to cool their servers and their distribution platforms. I think for the moment, they haven't fallen under the spotlight, have they?
No, absolutely. And I went last week to an event to launch the finance, the private finance agenda for COP26, at which Mark Carney, who's leading that work, Governor of the Bank of England, and David Attenborough was speaking, and Mark Carney was interviewing David Attenborough, and David Attenborough said, "We're very good currently at valuing Amazon, the company, but we're very bad at valuing the Amazon." And I thought that was a brilliant, sort of typically Attenborough-esque way of thinking about the challenge. There is a financial, a monetary value to positive and negative impact behaviours, and we need to get better at valuing them.
So I suppose the question is, how do you think you will measure your success in this venture?
Well, I think we will measure our success overall by how much we've, as I said at the beginning, how much we've moved impact investment up the agenda, particularly of policymakers and institutional investors. And to do that, we will be delivering a number of programmes, as what I've said suggests. I mean, we've got a very important communications programme and a policy and advocacy programme, but we're also doing some specific work addressed at, our focus is on big pools of capital. We want to mobilise big pools of capital, and our initial focus is going to be on DC pensions. There are a number of reasons, but one is that there's enormous demand from pension scheme members for their pensions to be allocated in a way that is delivering benefit for people and the planet as well as a financial return. Pension scheme trustees need to respond to that. There are some pension schemes in the UK and indeed outside. I mean, there are amazing, innovative, I think really innovative things being done in a number of countries around the globe, which the UK needs to learn from. But we need to help pension scheme trustees engage with impact, understand the benefits of investing in impact. And that's not just in terms of the financial returns that such investments can deliver. There are also a number of sort of portfolio management benefits. So we're building an evidence base really around impact for pension scheme trustees. We'll be engaging with not just trustees, but advisors. We also have an education program for financial advisors so that they can have much better informed conversations with clients around impact. And we'll be, as my younger colleagues refer to it, we'll have a very strong and engaging digital presence, not just a website. You'll know at the moment, if you Google impact investment, you get a sort of wave of very often conflicting information, some from commercial sources, some from non-commercial sources. We really want to help everyone, the public and institutional investors, navigate that landscape much more effectively. If you come to us, you won't always get the answer from us, but we will direct you to the right place to get the right answer.
So in thinking about this conversation today, I looked at the Norges Bank Investment Management website, and I see that they now list the companies from which they have divested. Is that the way we're going?
We feel very strongly, and it refers back to a question that you asked me earlier, that divestment is not the answer. If we all divested from fossil fuel companies, the lights would go out, not just in India and the developing world, but here in the UK. We need to really engage with companies so that they in turn engage with the transition to net zero. And I'm afraid we don't believe that divestment is the tool to deliver that. So it's a mixture of engagement. It's a mixture of pressure on companies to consider their impact. But really importantly, I mean, the example you gave of the Norwegian Sovereign Wealth Fund is a really wonderful example of how the pioneers in this field are really changing the debate and leading changing behaviour. Because obviously, as you know, I mean, we were saying that they have significant stakes in all national indices, stock market indices. They're such a powerful investment force. They've made really explicit some of their demands on companies. And a behaviour like that is really going to change companies' behaviour and indeed change all investors' behaviour.
So one's observed this go from really a current to a torrent. But it does appear that the UK and Europe are leading it. And I guess my question is, do you see conflict with the US, who at the moment appear not to have embraced this with such urgency?
I mean, there are a number of incredibly innovative initiatives and funds in the US. I think it's true that at the moment, the current US administration is not as on board with this agenda as the EU is. We feel very strongly that we would like all policymakers to be engaging a debate that moves us to international reporting and measurement standards and international convergence. That said, we should be celebrating some of the incredibly progressive and pioneering work that's going on in the EU around standards, around the conversations that asset managers, institutional investors must have with their clients. So we hope as the Institute to be very much engaged in making clear the UK's position on impact investment to the EU, but also supporting all efforts to move towards international standards and international convergence. I think there is, at the moment, a potential danger of bifurcation in the EU in particular, adopting really quite demanding and, as I say, progressive measures, and the rest of the world either not wanting to follow the EU or choosing not to follow the EU. And I think it would set back the long-term development of the market if that were to be the case.
So what's been the most challenging aspect of this job so far?
Well, I love the challenging aspects, or I wouldn't have left the FT. But I mean, the two areas I operate in two very different areas at the moment. One is around this feels incredibly valuable, potentially really valuable work. And it's really wonderful to be asked the types of questions that you're asking me and to be engaged in debate at all different levels, whether it's with government, with institutional investors, with the public. But at the same time, I'm running a startup. We have a quite unusual sort of business model in that we're a partnership of paid staff and a large network of very engaged volunteers, often from very senior levels of the financial services industry or indeed government. And my paid team at the moment is only, we're sort of 6 or 7 people. So really coming up with, trying to come up with an ambitious and credible work program and get it started whilst managing a small team, it's exciting, but it's hard work.
How would you encourage more women to go into the city and more firms to encourage that?
I think there's a whole range of answers to that. How long have you got? I mean, one of the things I believe very strongly, I was very influenced by the work of a wonderful professor who works at the Harvard Kennedy School, Iris Burnett, and she wrote a book called Gender Equality by Design, well, about gender equality in the workplace and how you deliver cultural change is not by changing mindsets, it's by changing processes. That's more difficult than standing up and saying, as many particularly male leaders do now, make it sort of rather trumpeting their feminist credentials. It's about actually changing many of your internal processes. So that's around recruitment, around promotion, around performance measurement, around how you run meetings, around how you construct senior leadership teams. I mean, one of the issues that I've tried to implement, which is challenging, is in interviews, you should interview one-to-one. You shouldn't have panel interviews because panel interviews tend to converge towards the consensus view. And you should do something really boring, which is you should ask every candidate the same set of questions. And then you should compare. You should have, of course, you can have other people interviewing the candidate. You can compare across answers with the other people who have been interviewing the candidate. But at the FT in particular, we always prided ourselves on our gut instinct and on these lovely chatty interviews with these wonderful, intelligent, dynamic young people who wanted to come and work with the FT. But that's not the way to build a diverse workforce, because if you do that, what do you end up with? You end up with people who you have a lovely chat with, who tend to look like you, they tend to think like you, they tend to have come from the same background as you. So I believe very firmly in changing processes, and that requires real nitty-gritty, boring work. It's a lot less easy than going to conferences and talking about what a wonderful employer you are.
Yeah, it's that cognitive dissonance that I think that many of us suffer from. Is there anything that you wish you'd known 20 years ago that you know today?
20 years ago, I was really quite old.
Not true.
I mean, there are things. Well, I was mid-career in many ways 20 years ago. I mean, what I think I would have liked very much, and is something that I listened to one of the most amazing, I think, business people and humans of our generation, is Demis Hassabis, who runs the DeepMind, now bit of Google, but it's AI. And he says his parents just let him do what he wanted, and which meant that he was, I think, video games champion of the world, age 13 or 14. And of course, he's now the most amazing AI scientist and also a very humble and rather amazing human being. But I wish that I'd allowed myself to follow my passions and to really do what I wanted to do rather than do what I thought I should do. And I think that young people nowadays, they have these wonderful options and they have career options that didn't even exist when I was coming into the workplace. They're going to have a long career because their longevity is, at least in this country, not if you're a poor woman, but for most people, your longevity is rising. They've got these incredible opportunities to have a really diverse career. And so I would just encourage them, or I wish I'd been encouraged, to say, what do you love? And pursue what you love. If you're lucky enough to be able to pursue what you love, that's both an incredible privilege, and I think you're most likely to do well.
Very good. Was there any specific teaching from your parents that stayed with you?
Oh, many, many. My mother worked as a teacher in one of the largest comprehensive schools in Southeast London, and she worked very hard, and she always instilled in me that for women, financial independence is absolutely critical. Money is power, and if you don't earn your own money and have your own career, you just don't have that power. So I think that's a very important lesson. I mean, it's less relevant now because my mother's generation, much larger proportion of my mother's generation, women weren't working, whereas we're all working now, which is great in many ways. But I think that enabling your own power and then using it is very important.
So I have two final questions. Would there be a book that you would encourage listeners to read? And do you have a favorite podcast?
Oh, well, my favorite podcast of all time was Serial. I'm desperately waiting for the next series of Serial. But in terms of books, I'm a great lover of the classics, but I was thinking that one of the most profoundly moving books I've reread recently was Half of a Yellow Sun by Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie, which is an amazing book about, well, it's set at the time of the Biafran War, but it's an even bigger book than that, wonderfully humane book about relationships and politics.
Half of a Yellow Sun. Well, Sarah, what an extraordinary journey and what terrific insights I think that I've taken away that corporations should really think about changing their process if they want to make the advancements they need to, and that younger people should think about following their passions, which probably wasn't the advice offered 30 years ago. So thank you very much indeed for being on the show.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode. The Money Maze podcast is free, and if you liked what you heard, please write a review on iTunes or Google Play to help others discover the show. If you'd like to keep up with our work, please search the Money Maze podcast on LinkedIn, at Money Maze podcast on Facebook, or at Money Maze podcast on Instagram. Finally, you'll find other information at our website, www.moneymazepodcast.com. Until next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. Guests and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.